The lending atmosphere was very, very different. Banks did not want to lend for properties, even for fantastic properties, which had held their values for 50 years before that. They didn't want to lend money for that. You know, I remember going to 9 banks in a row and be rejected. And I'd actually never faced rejection before that. And I was like, wow, this must be like some real bad thing going on, because banks like don't want to lend money to like a family which has 2 working physicians and buying a small property of $50,000.
Welcome to the Cashflow for Life podcast. We believe there are 2 types of people in this world. People that have greater cash flow coming in every single month, or people who have cash flow going out. We believe you need to be the type of person that has cash flow coming in, and that is what this podcast is all about. Our mantra is simple. If you take care of real estate for the first 5 years, real estate will take care of you for the rest of your life. If you're looking to achieve financial freedom through real estate investing, you're in the right place. Andrew Holmes, a renowned expert in the field, is your guide on this journey. Andrew is the driving force behind National RE Invest, the largest real estate investors association in the United States. Together, we're here to help you build wealth and create more cash flow in your life. Let's get into the show.
So from a cardiologist to a real estate developer, this is the journey of Dr. Anuja Gupta, and you guys are in for an awesome, awesome treat. So Anuja, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for the opportunity.
So let's jump right into it, right? Number one, originally, just for the audience that may be listening and or watching, where are you from originally?
I grew up in Bombay. Now it's called Mumbai. And I did my medical school, all of my education till medical school up there, then came out here to do the rest of my medical training.
Okay. So you basically are Indian, obviously, in terms of heritage. And then you came to America. And was this becoming a physician? Was this something like a family thing where you become either an engineer or a doctor? You know, the only other thing left is a lawyer, or you go to a grocery store or something like, or a quickie mart, right? How did you pick a doctor?
Yes, totally a family thing. I wanted to please my mom, and okay. I wanted to please my dad even more. So nobody else in my family was a doctor, and I'm still their favorite child because I became a doctor. And now I do full-time real estate, and my mom well knows that. But even now when she introduced me to someone, she'll be like, this is my daughter. She's a doctor.
She's a doctor, right. That's, I mean, you know, and it's for a lot of Indian families, people who are immigrants will understand this. Beyond money, it's like, oh my God, she's a doctor,
yeah,
right? Or she's a PhD, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's that pride comes through, and it has nothing to do with money, right? Nothing to do with money.
You could be the poorest doctor.
It's that sense of pride. It's that, you know, that my daughter did well kind of thing.
Yeah. And then, you know, it is a noble profession.
Sure.
And there's a certain amount of respectability that automatically goes with
it. You get, okay. And you had big shoes to fill, right? Your dad had done extremely well.
Extremely valuable, yes.
Right? And so it's like coming from that it's a matter of taking that legacy and what do I do with it, right? And so you had to kind of carve your own way. Would that be correct?
In some ways, yes. Okay. So much of the wealth came beyond my formative years.
Sure.
So I was around 20 till when the company that my dad founded started doing really, really well.
Right.
But by that time, you know, the values that you grew up with and the habits, the lifestyle, that was all set to a very moderate for those standards level, and I just continued with that.
Right. And I mean, literally, for those people that may know your background, I mean, that's like a Indian conglomerate today, right? What your dad built. So you come here to America, right? And then you kind of get into you wanted to always be a cardiologist, or how did that come about?
I guess I wanted to always be a cardiologist. It's just fun to deal with the heart. It's a pretty cool organ.
Okay.
And when I compare it to all other fields of medicine, it was definitely cooler. So,
right.
Yeah.
So you get in, you get patched for the residency, right? And was there something specific you specialized in?
I specialize in pediatric cardiology.
Okay, pediatric cardiology. So a challenging field to begin with.
Yes. And then right. I further specialize in neonatal pediatric cardiology.
Oh, wow. So neonatal pediatric cardiologist. Now, let me ask you this. Why would somebody that's clearly for that, I'm sure you had to go through your trials and tribulations, get to that place in life where most people would be like, oh my God, she's a very accomplished woman. Your husband happens to be a physician also, right? He's a cardiologist as well.
Correct.
Right? So why would you come up with a crazy idea like, oh my God, I'm going to get into real estate?
So that was temporary insanity, and that turned into permanent insanity after that.
Okay.
That explains it.
Okay, got it. So did you have your own practice? Were you at a hospital? And then is this like, was something I'm going to do on the side?
Yes. So when I first started out, I was employed by a hospital, very highly paid professional. And when you're in medicine, you have a bit of a chip on your shoulder.
Sure.
You know, you've studied for so many years. And then finally, when you get your first job and that first big paycheck comes, it's a very empowering feeling.
Sure.
So transitioning from that high horse to real estate was a big adjustment for me. But what I was really looking for and was really lacking was flexibility in my schedule and time for myself, my family. My daughter was 2 years old at the time, and I hated working full time, coming home and being just exhausted and consumed and no patience. I was not spending quality time with her. Same for my husband. So I knew that one of us had to cut back and do something else when she grew up. And it was easier for me to do that. So that's what I did.
Okay. So basically, this was a choice that you made that kind of grew into a passion. Would that be a right way to say it?
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And what was the inspiration? Because a lot of times people will go to an event, a seminar for you, right? You were used to kind of going to school, that sort of thing. What was that transition like into real estate for you?
It was a bit of an accident. I was attending a conference by a company called Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Okay.
Back then, they used to be really big in financial education and real estate education. At that conference, I remember it being a real eye-opener. What they were saying was to be truly financially independent, you cannot be a daily professional earning a daily income, even if you earn a very high daily income. And you really needed to build real assets to build long-term wealth. And I don't know why, but at 35 years of age, that was the first time I'd heard that message. And I was like, wow, like, and they literally said that most professionals, even very highly paid professionals, were kind of like under the control of earning a daily income. And the day you stopped working for that, that day your income stream would go away. Now you do build some assets on the side, but for most people, that's a side thought. It's not a goal of your life. So when I started really looking things that way and seeing where I would get in 5, 7, 10, 15, 20 years being a physician, I really thought I wanted to build real financial independence, real long-term assets, and real estate was the obvious choice.
Got it. So somebody once said that, you know, you can, if you want to be rich, become a doctor. If you want to be wealthy, go into real estate, right? Would you agree with that? Because you've done both, right?
Totally.
Now, you know a lot of people that are well off, right? You're kind of pretty active in the community. You know a lot of people well off. When you look at that and when you look at it from your perspective, right? Because you have a little bit of an insider's look. And a lot of times what people are trained, like if we use the analogy from Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and I say running on a treadmill to, you know, owning treadmills. These are two different things. And running on a treadmill is, if you're a barista at a coffee shop, you have a treadmill where you show up for 8 hours. As you become a manager, it has more buttons, more responsibilities. If you become a doctor, you have even a fancier treadmill, which says MD in front of it, right? And then it's harder to replace you. And the harder it is to replace you to run on a treadmill, the more you're going to get paid.
True.
Right? But yet, if you get laid up, right? We would actually orthopedic surgeon in Mastery, extremely well. Down for 2 months with sciatic issues, big time sciatic issues, and the hospital fires him.
Yeah, it happens.
Right? And people don't see that side of medicine. Was that something you started seeing on your end of it, where you realized that maybe just running on the treadmill is not enough? Because you had lived that part of it. You had made your parents proud. And was it time to kind of move on?
It was a couple of things. It was me wanting to have flexibility in my schedule to be with my young daughter. But it was also seeing things like half your paycheck going towards taxes. It was starting to really make me feel like, what are you working for? And how are you going to get to the end of life or, you know, your life, achieve your life goals with what you're doing now. And the more I educated myself attending conferences and, you know, offered by companies like yours,
sure,
which do a really great job of explaining what real financial independence is about, I figured that it wouldn't, that being a cardiologist and having a really nice income would only take me so far. What I really wanted to do was build long-term assets.
So before I kind of jump to the next aspect of it, the question I want to ask you, because, I mean, we all start out, right, somewhere where you're not making a lot of money, right? And then you get to a point where maybe you're making 300,000, 4,000, even a million, right? But once you get to 4,000, there's no difference in terms of lifestyle between 400 and 500. Now you got to go to 800 or a million to really have a significant difference.
Yeah.
Right? And then you get to a million. Now, what are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to drive? What are you going to live in? That gets to a point where it goes from just earning a paycheck to building wealth.
Yeah.
Right? That is that kind of a thought process you went through?
Yes.
Okay. So first time, right? We're going to eventually get to a point where you built, I mean, you buy this piece of land and you go through the whole development phase. But a lot of times people fail to realize you started with very humble beginnings, right? So when is it that you first started buying real estate, and where was it and what year was it? Because that'll put the time, place, and the condition of the market for the audience that's listening.
Sure. I think I got a really great break in starting real estate at the right time. The Chicago market was in the midst of a crash. It was 2008-09 time period. I had been looking at buying some properties in the downtown area for a few years, and suddenly those properties were dropping in value, and not just dropping by 5, 10, 15%, they were dropping in value by 30, 40, 50%. And, you know, many people say in downtown Chicago, it's hard to make the numbers work. It was hard to make the numbers work when the properties were full priced, but at 50% off, it was easier to make the numbers work. So I thought that was a great time to get in. And I think I really got lucky with the timing.
Right. And I think it's luck is when opportunity meets preparedness. You have to be prepared first, right? And then the right opportunity, and it kind of comes in place. But a lot of times people are like, oh my God, that was luck. And literally, if at that time you had talked to most people were running for the hills.
You know, you're so right. And when you talk about preparedness, I remember at that time people saying, what makes you think it's not going to drop another 10, 15, 20% from here? And I thought about that and I was like, you know, the numbers work nicely at where it's now, which was 30, 40, 50% of its high price. And I was okay with that. And even if it fell another 10, 15, 20%, numbers were still working.
You know, and for the audience to understand, it's like literally you could pick up a condo, right? Small condos downtown, overlooking the lake, literally. It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Right? $60,000, $70,000,
$80,000.
Yeah. You could pick up properties, right? And today, the same properties are $250,000, $300,000,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it was an amazing time. And yet, at the time, financing was hard.
Yes.
Right? Even for somebody like you, financing was hard.
Very hard.
Right?
Yes.
And a lot of times, we were talking just before we got started, a lot of times, when you get into real estate or you want to build wealth, you have to take an inventory. Number one, where's the market? Number two, who are you? Meaning, where does the money come from? Right? And it's like, if you're driving Uber or if you're a doctor or anything in between, you can use real estate, as I feel it's the greatest equalizer. But how you go about it is going to be a little bit different,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so at the time, you take a little bit of your savings. Now, mind you, your husband married a cardiologist.
Yes.
He did not marry a, quote-unquote, this woman who's lost her mind.
Correct.
And is going to be a real estate professional,
yeah,
now.
He found what that out later.
What was his take on that at that time?
You know, thankfully, he is such a great, supportive husband. I really mean it when I say this, that I'm able to do the crazy things that I do only because I have a supportive husband like him. So he will support anything I do. If I say, let's go to the moon, he would be like, okay, let's prepare our little family to go to the moon.
Okay. But I mean, that's just who he is.
Yeah.
Right? That's just who he
is. Yeah, no,
that...
I really lucked out in that department.
Right. Okay. So because he's kind of, we were laughing about it, that, I mean, I'd say he's like one of those doctor monks. He's very happy doing what he does. and he wants to do it till probably the rest of his life. And he's happy with that.
Very happy with it. Doesn't ever even look at his paychecks. Actually doesn't matter to him how much he gets paid to do what he does. Just happy doing it.
Okay. I mean, that's his passion, period.
Yeah.
So, it helps.
He's a content man.
Okay. And it helps. And the reason I bring that up, reason I ask that is a lot of times, right, this type of a thing, somebody gets a harebrained idea. And this is a harebrained idea. I mean, if there ever was one, you are making a ton of money and suddenly you lost your mind in the middle of the largest market crash in real estate. This woman is going to now go and invest in real estate. I mean, it just sounds crazy when you think about it now.
Yeah.
Right. And at that time, see, looking back, right, anybody can be a bloody genius when you look in the back rear view mirror.
Yeah.
But yet when you're going through that, right, it just sounds bizarre. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it is bizarre. Like you said, it was a scary time. It really was a scary time. And the lending atmosphere was very, very different. Banks did not want to lend for properties, even for fantastic properties, which had held their values for 50 years before that. They didn't want to lend money for that. You know, I remember going to 9 banks in a row and being rejected. And I'd actually never faced rejection before that. And I was like, wow, this must be like some real bad thing going on, because banks like don't want to lend money to like a family which has 2 working physicians and buying a small property of $50,000.
And perfect scores and that. And yeah, you had all your ducks in a row.
Yeah.
Right. And it's funny you say that. I went to 24 banks at that time, right, to get a loan for $60,000 on a property with completely rehabbed. We bought it, rehabbed it, refinanced. I mean, and I was just looking for a refi.
Yeah.
And the banks were like, oh yeah, great idea, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, you know, for the longest time, I don't know about you, I thought it was a personal rejection. Right.
I mean, the same.
I was like, oh my God, same. I'm such a loser. I'm 32 years old. Yes. Right. And I'm like, I'm such a loser. And what gives me the right to think I'm going to be a real estate multimillionaire, right?
Yeah.
So it's...
No, it's a mindset change, you know. Right. For me too, like, I had grown up pretty entitled. And, you know, being a doctor, a cardiologist, it comes with its nice perks. And I never really faced rejection. So to be rejected for a real estate loan for $50,000 was... an eye-opener for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's BS.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's just BS, because yeah, you're like, hey, man, I make that a month.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right? But yet, that's where the market, right? Today, we can laugh about it because we understand the nuances of what they were saying no to.
Yeah.
Or those banks were traditional banks and they did not have a portfolio product. Right? And which now they're bending over backwards to make crazy loans.
Yes. And you know, it took me like rejection of 9 banks to get to that 10th right, bank, which was a portfolio bank who like kind of bet on me at that time. And thankfully I did okay.
And so how many units did you guys end up buying, right?
We, over 3 or 4 years, we built up a portfolio of 88 units.
88 units. Okay. And so 88 units, you were buying them. Were these in, were they performing, or were they, you buying them out of foreclosure, getting them fixed and then putting them on rent?
No, these were beautiful condo properties in downtown Chicago, in the nicest parts of downtown, in Gold Coast, in River North, in Streeterville. They were in beautiful high-rises with doormen and swimming pools and lake views, and they were just half off.
And they would cash flow, right? Because she said a lot of things. Number one, you're downtown. You're a million-dollar location. The market was basically where it had just gone to the, basically, you know, in a tube. You have a doorman, you have all the niceties, yet the discount that you were getting was a 50, 60, 70% discount, literally,
yeah,
on the dollar,
yeah,
right? And just because of the market conditions.
Yeah.
And they would cash flow, even at that time. The rents weren't anywhere commensurate to where they are today.
No.
Right? But yet they would cash flow. Why? Because of the economy.
Yeah. You know, you say this all the time. I've heard you say this all the time, that it's all about the numbers, and if the numbers don't make sense, then even the best property is not a good deal. It is so true. It is really just a game of numbers. I mean, that same property 6 months, 1 year ago was a really bad deal. And then 6 months into the crash, it was cash flowing.
It was cash flowing like crazy.
Yes.
Right. It's the market timing, the numbers, right? So it's not just about the right location. It depends on what time in history and when you bought it.
The timing.
Right. It's a big deal. So you were at the right place at the right time. And you had the initiative to say that I'm going to take action, because that's the other part of it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because everybody saw it. Any
yes.
working professional, they had the extra literally 40, 50, 60,000 bucks
yeah.
to buy properties all over. And this was across the country.
Yeah.
So you buy a bunch of these properties, they're cash flowing. So at least that becomes that, okay, oh my God, this works.
Yes.
Right? Once that worked, was there at a time, you know, you went to events, you went to, did you meet somebody that at that time was maybe a mentor, somebody you looked up to that said, you know, you're doing the right thing? Because we all have those people. Who was that for you? Because you went from there to where you used to practice down in Bourbonnaise.
Yes.
Right? How did that kind of come about?
There was a lot of self-doubt in okay. that period. The first 5 years were really, I would say, looking back, a hot mess.
Right.
You just went from one thing to another. But the timing just seemed so right. And, you know, going back to like knowing what the market was before the crash, that really gave you the confidence to just keep going, because sooner or later, and, you know, when you have a down cycle, it's hard to think this down cycle is going to end soon at some point and then turn around and be an up cycle right. again. And there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of doubt. But if you just believe that real estate is very cyclical, that a down cycle will become an up cycle, an up cycle will become a down cycle. All you have to do is, you know, buy in the down cycle and sell in the up cycle.
And wait, I mean, and this brings me to another point, that a lot of times, if you look at people who have old money today, that are considered kind of old money today, right? A lot of them, yes, did they have businesses? Sure, right? Did they make a lot of money with those businesses? Sure. But they were not, quote unquote, the billionaires,
yes.
right? They are today. They had more money than most people because clearly they'd run big businesses,
yeah.
right? But during the down cycle, if you look at the Kennedys, you look at some of these, quote unquote, family money,
mm-hmm.
during the down cycle, they doubled down. They bought and they bought and bought.
Yeah.
The properties appreciated, and then they refinanced out.
Yes.
Right? And they have a field day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the average person is like, oh my God, they always, no, they didn't have that kind of wealth. Right? The wealth multiplied because of that upswing. Would that be?
Absolutely. Yes. Right? You know, like you, they always say in real estate that you make your money when you buy the property. Not when you sell the property,
right?
It's so true.
And it's like a lot of times people, and especially today, we see this all the time, social media, right? It's all about how hard can you run? How many things can you do,
yeah.
right? Guys, it's not about that. It's about less movement and more returns.
Yeah.
It's never about basically cycling the whole thing. So you are downtown. What was kind of the next move?
So after building the portfolio up to 88 properties, the market had come to a nice upcycle. Around 5 years after I started, I sold about half the portfolio. And
was that hard at that time? Because you're getting good cash flow out of it.
Yeah, getting great cash flow. For me, I'm the kind of person who feels like I need to keep challenging myself with something different.
I mean, there's something wrong with you, Anuja. I mean, I genuinely mean it, right? Because you're just one of those people that
yeah.
you're looking for the next challenge,
yeah.
right?
And it's not just like a cheap thrill.
Right.
It actually should be a real life-threatening, complex challenge
right.
to make me feel
right.
like that's what I want to do.
But that's just how you're built.
Yeah.
Okay. So you sell the portfolio. What did you do next?
There was this piece of land next to my medical practice. I had been driving across this land for many years. And every time I would look at the land, I would be like, wow, it would be so nice if somebody built some nice rentals on this land. The hospital is next door. All the new people who come would love to have nice rentals close by.
Where is this?
This is in South Suburban Chicago, about 50 miles south of downtown in a suburb called Bourbonnais.
Guys, so people who may not be familiar with the geography, this is a place where there are more cows than people. Right? Meaning what I'm trying to mean, I'm being facetious, of course. It's
farmland
country.
Farmland
I mean,
country.
It's literally...
Middle of nowhere.
Literally middle of nowhere. But yet it's these small little pockets. And a lot of times what people will do is they're like, oh my God, I want to go downtown. Right? I want to go where everybody... Guys, a lot of times it's easier to be a big fish in a small pond than to try to compete in the bigger pond. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can literally do some things in smaller places sometimes and get an astronomical return.
Astronomical.
Right? So you go there and what happens?
So this is a piece of land which so many times I thought about, why isn't someone doing something with this piece of land? Why aren't they building some nice rentals? I'd been in real estate for 5 years. I'd done some sales. I'd done rentals. I'd done leasing, property management, kind of like all things about real estate. And what I realized was there was a real shortage of good rentals in that town. And so whenever I'd see that land, I'd be like, I wish somebody would like build some nice rentals there. And one day when I was crossing it, I was like, I think I can build the rentals. And it was just a random thought. But when I just kept thinking about it, the thought didn't leave my mind. And sooner or later, I had bought this land and I was going to build some good quality rentals on it.
Got it. So basically from being a landlord owning condos, you now are going to go all the way on the other side, which is you're going into development.
Yes.
Are you enjoying the show thus far? You know what they say, knowledge is not power, but rather it's the application of knowledge that is power. That's why we are excited to announce the new dates for our Build Your Empire 3-day conference and property tour. At this game-changing event, you'll discover how to build lasting wealth with real estate, learn step-by-step methods, avoid common mistakes, and get insights from dozens of real estate and financial experts. If you are listening to the podcast, you know that real estate is a team sport, and we're here to introduce you to the local pros who can help you every step of the way. This event is your opportunity to walk through active real estate deals in Chicago and nearby neighborhoods. And the best part is, you can either attend live or virtually. Go to andrewholmesevents.com and get your early bird tickets now. At the event, you'll see properties being transformed into flips, rentals, or wholesale properties, giving you a rare and valuable learning experience outside the classroom. Meet and learn from successful students who've profited from our mentorship. Hear their stories and struggles, and discover how you can follow in their footsteps, regardless of your background or experience. And so much more. We also have a VIP package that will give you access to our exclusive networking sessions and an opportunity to connect and meet with Andrew himself. Plus, we even give you a hot lunch all of the days you are there. For more information and to secure your spot, visit andrewholmesevents.com. We sell out every time, so don't miss this opportunity to transform your real estate career. We will see you at our next event. And now, back to the show.
So let me ask you this, right? Because this is kind of funny. You come from the Indian community. I come from the Indian community, right? Our people understand doctors. We understand engineers. We understand, okay, lawyers, some of it, right? We understand how to run a quickie mart, right? Those kind of businesses. But when you say to somebody, Anuja, what do you do? Do they even understand what the heck you do today?
No, right? No.
They're like, oh, you do real estate. Oh, yeah, she's a real estate agent.
She sells homes.
She
has
right?
homes, yes. Yeah.
Because
no, development
even in our community, as well as Indian people have done, we're not making a dent on this side of the business yet,
no,
right?
No.
Certainly on the physicians at the motel side, we have made a big, big, big dent,
yes.
Right? You know, I was saying to somebody off topic a little bit that by the next generation, which is your kids' generation, right? Indians today are doing extremely well in terms of earned income, right? Number one, no question. But they're going to rule America, right?
There's no doubt.
There's no doubt in my mind, right? There's no doubt. Because I think we're uniquely positioned where our parents beat it into us.
Yeah.
You're nothing, right? You don't have any value.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and if you don't work hard, you won't get anywhere.
You won't get anywhere. And I think that work ethic, and because we have seen how it is on the other side, and the value of education is pounded into our brains. We come here, we're like, oh my God, right? It's like everything is at your fingertips if you're just willing to work.
You're going to work harder than anyone else you know.
So part of this drive, you think it comes from culture, it comes from uniquely your family, because I see that similar trait in different ways in a lot of Indian families.
Yeah.
You think that's what it is?
You know, it's your values growing up and what you see your parents doing, what people around in your family, you see them doing. I have personally struggled to teach my daughter those values.
Right.
Her growing up in America with everything handed to her, it's been hard to instill that drive in her,
right.
to make her feel motivated. I've made it my personal mission to do what I can about that in the next 1 or 2 years. She's 18 now. And before she gets to 20, I want her to have that drive.
But do you think part of it is maybe your own fault? Or it's kind of one of those things, right, that I want to give the best to my child, right? That some things that you were without, were the kind of the things that put that, drive in you? Part of it is that, oh my God, I want to provide the best for my child, because you're trying, as a parent, you're trying to do the best for your kid.
Yeah. And it's not even about providing the best for your child. You want them to live up to their potential. For me, it's about that.
Sure.
I feel like my daughter can grow up and be whatever she wants. She can be the president of the United States if that's what she wants, but she needs to have that drive. So to live up to your potential, how are you going to develop that motivation and that drive? Right. This is what I struggle with my daughter.
Like growing up with a little bit of lack of certain things, I think it helps. It helps tremendously.
Sure.
Right. And in India, even if like for both my parents were physicians, right? So I literally, even compared to most people at that time, we'd be considered quote unquote well off.
Yeah.
But I mean, I thought you're nothing. Whatever we earned, we had nothing.
Yeah.
We built everything.
Yeah, we built everything.
You have nothing, right? And you're not grateful, right? I mean, no, this was the thing. And it was like beat into us from a child. And so it was like, okay, man, I'm going to show them. Right?
And
I'm going to show
them. The value of that culture is so great, right? It is one of the most valuable things.
You know, it's funny how when you're a child, you think your parents are geniuses. When you get to be 18, they don't know anything.
Yeah.
When you get to be 35, oh my God, they were geniuses, right? I'm so grateful, right? That you go back a full circle because what they said when you were 15, 16, you understand when you're 30.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And they've always been the same. You were a fool and now you've grown up and know what real life is
about. So let's go back to kind of Bourbonnaise, right? What was that like at that time? Did you go, did you do a 1031 exchange out of your downtown properties, because you would have had a tremendous gain over there, obviously? Or did you just sell them and dump the money? You could pay the taxes and dump the money.
Yeah. I wish I had like the sophistication of knowing what a 1031 exchange is back then. But having come from a medical kind of background, I was still learning what real estate was about. And definitely the programs like the 1031 exchange would have been so good. But that's not right. I just sold it. Felt very good to sell them and to make out really well.
So in India, we say, beta, bahut paisa banaya.
Ha.
Right? That means, man, I made a lot of money, right?
Felt like a windfall.
It's like a windfall, but then you realize on the other side of it,
got a big tax check,
That's going back to the rich dad, poor dad, right?
Yeah.
That level of sophistication that you can trade out of this and trade into something else, that's a whole different type of learning.
Yeah, comes with the right education, the right exposure. What you're doing in your group, in your company is amazing. I wish I'd like learned the right way to do these things.
No, it's funny because we became friends afterwards, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of times when you have that, because I think that's what it is. A lot of times when you see people that are doing fun things and that share that, hey man, I tried. It's not like, look where I'm at. It's look where we can go, right? That if I can accomplish something, so can you, and we can make the pie as big as possible.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of times, I think, especially with immigrant communities, oh my God, I found a secret. I can't share it with anybody else. Because if anybody else finds out about it, oh my God, right? Then I'm not special
The scarcity mindset, yes.
So at the time, you pay the tax, you build this community, you GC'd it out, I imagine.
I did. And, I told you that the first 5 years of building the portfolio felt like a hot mess. The experience with my first development was a real disaster.
Right.
So after I bought the land, I got the plans made, I got the permits. I had a friend who was a general contractor. And on the first day of the job, he gets this big deposit from me. And then he doesn't show up on the second day and never after that.
Friendship thing doesn't quite relate to business,
No, it's disastrous. What I found out later was that he had severely underquoted the job and had no confidence of delivering it at the price that he had quoted. So he just kind of disappeared.
Right. I mean, because at that time, you have no idea what the infrastructure cost is going to be, right? You have no idea of what all is involved. He said it. You're like, okay, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great because it fits in my numbers.
Right? And you just trust people and you just go based on that.
Yeah.
Again, bad moves in business, but you go through those.
But, it's like one of those things, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
Right. And you want to hear positive news.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's that, what is that called? Information bias.
Yeah.
Right. They're telling you what you want to hear. You're like, oh my God, great. I'm genius. Must be that I'm right. And you go over the numbers 50 times. You're like, hey man, everything. And it seems all to confirm your information bias at that time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you know what they say about entrepreneurs, that it's a good thing entrepreneurs don't know what is coming down the line, because if they did, there wouldn't be too many entrepreneurs in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, engineer is that guy that checks the flow of the river and then goes downriver. Right. Yeah. Entrepreneur is that guy that's like, hey, man, there's a river. Right.
Let me jump
and
in.
It's like, you know, it would be exciting to go up the river.
Yeah.
Right? Because everybody's going down the river. I'm going to go up the river. Right. And without a paddle.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and sometimes, and a lot of times, you know, I truly believe this, that for every 10,000 entrepreneurs that fail, there's one person that's successful. Right. Because this quote unquote entrepreneurial dream, right, it's a fantasy at best.
It's a fantasy.
Right? And this is not brought up as much. But guys, listen, good intentions does not lead to good results.
No, they right? only take you so far. Yeah.
So what was the end outcome of it? Did you keep those properties after you built them? You refinanced them, I imagine, out of the construction loan.
Yes. Right? Got a construction loan, build the properties, and then refinance them. They got rented before the housing was even completed. Around 7 years later now, they've already paid for themselves three times over.
Right. So you basically really just, yeah, you basically just paid them down.
Yeah.
Then you decided to have another adventure.
Another adventure.
Right. And that was in Hanover Park.
Yeah, in Hanover Park.
Okay.
Yes.
So you go to a sleepy community, build that, do well with it. Then did you do a refinance again to buy the Hanover Park thing? How did you swing that?
Yeah, it was from the last refinance of the first development.
So for those people that may be familiar with the geography of Chicago, if you've lived here for a while and you're familiar with the Streamwood, Hanover Park area, that used to be a massive Menards over there,
yeah.
Right? How big was that acreage where you, that lot where you bought?
It was an 11-acre site.
11-acre site.
Yes. And what I really was looking for was a 5-acre site, but I didn't find any good 5-acre site. So this 11-acre site, oddly enough, was like fitting my budget. So I bought it.
Got it. Okay. It's interesting because at the time I saw your picture here, you were promoting Veranda, right? And what was your vision for that? Because you had this kind of grandiose vision, which took a long time for this, again, I mean, an entrepreneur going up the hill kind of thing,
yeah.
Right? What was the vision for you?
So it was a little bit of a passion project. When you've done well for a few years in real estate, you become very confident. You become overconfident and you feel like you can solve the complex problems of this world. So when I was a practicing physician, I was the medical director of an assisted living facility. And the owner of this facility was also the owner of a company that managed assisted living facilities for all of Illinois. And one day he said to me, where do your people go, meaning Indian people, where do they go when they're looking for assisted living care? Because I operate 80,000 assisted living beds in Illinois and I don't have even one Indian patient. And that really got me thinking of where do our Indian people go when they need assisted living care? Because they had the same incidence of conditions that led to assisted living, just like everybody else. So why aren't they going to assisted living facilities? And where are they going if they're not going there? So I started this quest of like finding out, talking to elderly people I knew and parents of friends. And what I found out was Indian people can't seem to survive in mainstream assisted living facilities because the barriers of daily living are just too high. So things like food, the language, the staff, the entertainment, the engagement, everything, it's a barrier even in the short term. And I'd often seen that when Indian people would get admitted to the hospital, beyond a few days, they would get very, very antsy, much more than other people about going home. They just cannot stay and put up with those barriers in the long term.
Especially, you know, as you get older and you're the first generation,
yeah,
right? It's really an issue because you revert back to your childhood.
Yeah.
Right. As you get older, you want more of that home.
Yeah.
You want people with similar culture, similar upbringing, right? I mean, when you're young, you're working, blah, blah, everything is great.
Yeah.
Right. As you get older, and that's a natural thing.
Yeah.
Right. Doesn't matter if you come from Italian culture or whatever culture you come from,
yeah,
you revert back to that.
Yeah.
So to go and as you're older, to go and assimilate becomes very tough.
Very tough.
Right?
Indian people in mainstream retirement communities would feel kind of dismissed, ignored, left to themselves.
Sure.
They would not mainstream themselves.
Yeah, no, because
they
cultural differences.
Very cultural, I mean, yes.
That's just how it is, right?
Yeah.
And so your vision was kind of a bigger vision, right? Rather than just putting up a bunch of townhouses. First time I met you, it was like, oh my God, this woman is smart. But I'm like, what the heck is she thinking? Right? No, I mean, like literally, I'm like, you could may have made your life a hell of a lot easier by building beautiful townhouses,
for
getting
sure.
rid of them.
Yeah.
Right? But you wanted to build a community for people, of Indian origin, right, as they retire.
Yeah, and it was going to be like a multicultural community where minorities felt comfortable being around people like themselves, other minorities.
So it did come to fruition, obviously.
It came to fruition.
I mean, you went through a lot of heartache.
Yeah, it was a global pandemic.
Right.
What I learned was cycles, the real estate is truly cyclical, and you have to endure the down cycles just like you enjoy the up cycles. But every one day of the up cycle feels like 1,000 days in the down cycle. And it was an exceedingly hard period to go through. But, you know, you just put your head down and get to work. And sooner or later, all periods come to an end.
Right. Because, I mean, that's the first thing. Like, it was in my mind when I met you, I'm talking about it to you. I'm like, when I got a background of what you had accomplished already, and I'm going to Anuja because I didn't understand what exactly where she was going with this at the time. And I'm like, Anuja, but what is your cash on cash return? You're doing all of this stuff. When this was my first question,
yeah,
I'm like, hey,
I remember that.
You know, you built, you did what you did downtown. This is amazing, right? I can relate to it. You did what you did in Bourbonnais. This is perfect. I can relate to that. But with this whole thing, because the amount of heartache that goes into building what you built. How many townhouses did you build there?
There are 50 townhomes and
50 townhomes.
A clubhouse.
And what was that in terms of dollar amount? What was the TIF that you were trying to get over there?
So the vision for the whole land, the 11 acres, is a continuum of care retirement community. And the continuum is an independent living part and then a assisted living part. The independent living part is where people come in when they're healthy, active, social. So that part of our development is complete. There are 50 townhomes and a clubhouse. The average age of the people is about 75. And they formed a nice little community and they are happy there.
Yeah.
The second
Do you see, like, I mean, coming from the Indian culture, do you see your parents, your grandparents in these people? Because it's like, right? I mean, they must come to you and say, oh my God, Anuja, we're so, right? I mean, have you had those moments?
We've definitely had those moments, and those moments are what make all the headache, heartache worth it. You live for those moments, but also when you get to a certain level in your career, when you've made money, and especially for me, I like grew up very privileged, you feel like you've reached a phase in your life where you want to solve some complex problem yourself.
Correct.
And leave your own little
legacy. Yeah.
And that was what Veranda was about.
So on a project like that, right, did you have to refinance kind of the project in Bourbonnais to pull out? Because you need, I mean, that's not a 11 acre, and this is in the middle of a suburban Chicago.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
You're dealing with the towns. You have to go make friends with the mayor. You have to go rub shoulders with the right people. You have to, because you have to develop those relationships.
Yeah.
And that's, in fact, more important than, yeah, quote, unquote, just the building aspect of it.
Truly. Being a developer, building the construction part is just one small part of everything else that you have to do.
Right. So since I've known you, I mean, people look at the other success, I'm like, oh my God, this woman is connected. Right. I mean, but were you always this way, even as a physician, or did you have to start realizing that I have to get out in the community? Doesn't matter just in the American community. It doesn't matter what it is, but I have to start getting that exposure because a lot of entrepreneurs don't understand that side of it.
Yeah. Actually, I was quite the opposite. Being a doctor, I was happy in my little clique of doctor friends, and I hadn't really even thought about venturing out to know what the community was about and getting to know the people. But I've always prided myself for doing whatever it takes to do. And if it required for me to really get to know the whole town, to get to know the mayor, the whole town council, a large part of the community groups that were there in that part of the town, then that's what I had to do. So it was like a mission I set for myself. It was a goal, and I would intentionally keep reaching out to people. When I first bought the land out there, I knew one person in Schaumburg. There was one person, just one person I knew. But I made it a mission that from this one person, I'm going to know 10 people. And from those 10 people, I'm going to know 100 people. And this kind of continued for a few years. But within 3 years or so, by the end of 3 years, I think I'd got to know the whole town Got to know a lot of the influential people, the decision makers, the policy makers, and even beyond.
No, and because this is, and the reason I bring that up is a lot of times, right, we're happy in our little bubble, but if you want to do something like this, right, you really have to understand how things work, how, because at the end of the day, you're trying to sell that town on helping you get through a lot of these things. And the agendas don't match, and one person doesn't like that. I mean, it's just, it's people. At the end of the day, you're dealing with people.
It's very
complex. So it's nothing, I mean, it's nothing for one. So it, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
And they don't care about you unless they know you care about them.
True.
And your care comes first.
Yeah.
Right? Before, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, gone are the old days of Chicago, right?
Right.
So today it's based on going and shaking hands, getting to know people, understanding the town policy, and then working within the structure, right? I mean, just the whole thing that people think it's a pond, right? That you had to dig over there. And what is that thing? That's okay. A retention pond, which most people don't understand.
Yeah, and it was an actual pond. It was the most expensive pond known to man. It took me $1 million to build that 1 acre pond.
Right,
yes.
And these are things we don't think about, right?
No.
That whenever you start developing, you're like, who would think that you need an area for water to go?
Yeah.
Right? This is water management.
Yeah.
Right? And this is 101 for somebody who's done development.
Yeah.
But you're going to have to dig, and you're going to have to dig a bigger pond than what is needed.
Yes.
And these are things that a lot of times people are not prepared for, and it shows up nowhere in your business plan.
Nowhere. And if you feel like you're prepared, you are in for a rude shock, because you'll find out of all the things that you're not prepared for right on the next day. I think development is not meant for everyone. You have to be a real risk taker. You have to be okay with taking that risk. You have to have good stress management in yourself and for your business and for your family. And you have to have a cushion.
So remember during Corona, one day you called me, right? Or we're talking on the phone, and she goes, Andrew, you know, come by. I want to just sit down. Talk. And, you know, guys, these are one of those things that clearly at the time, right? You put this subdivision together, you're selling few of the properties. A lot of it is in the middle of development.
Yeah.
And boom, the market stops.
Yes, the market.
It just came to a dead stop.
Dead stop. And then continued on that for 2 years. So
right.
I remember calling you. I wanted to just pick your brain of what I should do. It was really a scary place to be
right.
in. And
no,
to
and
have this
see,
development
you know,
on
and
your
it's,
hand.
It's interesting when you see that pain that you only feel in your gut,
yeah,
right? And when you see somebody who's a friend and you're like, what do you say at the time,
yeah,
right? I mean, you can't BS somebody that you're like, hey, man, I understand what you're going through, meaning that you're like, here, I put this whole thing together. Who knows what this Corona thing is? I mean, like at the time, everybody was trying to, you know, really come to reality. What the heck is this?
Yeah.
Is this what we take seriously? We don't take seriously. Is it BS? Is it not, right? I mean, this whole, we were in this phase of just unknown. And
yeah.
Now suddenly
but one thing I've like come to find out was true. One thing I knew for certainty, it was the absolute worst time to bring a retirement community to the market.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, there's absolutely no question
yeah.
about that. But it was interesting because, and she's like, hey, Andrew, you want to have a drink? I'm like, I don't drink that much to begin with. But I'm like, I'm not sure if I need a drink or she needs a drink.
Yeah,
for sure she needed a drink.
I needed
no,
a
it was
drink,
a, it
and
was
I needed
definitely,
a friend, and I needed a shoulder to cry on.
Right. No, and it's those moments, guys, right, where it's sometimes there's nothing else you can do except just try to understand where the person is coming from. Right? It was what it was. The world was being shut down. And you're like, I have no idea. And at the time, and I'm like, Anuja, man, if I was, just rent it out. Just rent it out, right? So that at least, you know, you don't feel the squeeze.
Yeah.
Because even if you have money, how long do you keep supporting that?
Not too
right?
long.
Right? I mean, there comes a point
yeah.
where you're like, oh my God, what do I do here?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you went through that phase. Now, obviously, past that, did you sell all the properties?
No, a few of them are still rented.
Few of them are
yes,
still rented.
But they rented very well.
Was this during Corona?
During COVID.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was during COVID. And that's where I was like, you know, the heck.
Yeah. And, you know, it was a for sale project. And
yeah.
you were the first person who came along and said, just rent it.
Right.
You were there for an hour. You looked at the property and you probably gave me the best advice for this property that anybody else could have
No, because here's
done.
The deal. The difference is, it's like, again, knowing your background, like, I'm like, listen, even if you make another $1 million, it's not going to change your lifestyle, right? It's not going to change your lifestyle. I know it and you know it, right? Now, obviously your goal was that I'm going to sell this.
Right.
Right. That was your goal. So even though it may seem like, oh my God, I mean, I didn't quite accomplish that, in the long run, you're going to be laughing all the way
to
the bank.
No, I love owning the properties. They've actually done quite well.
Right.
And one, you get like this feeling of accomplishment that you like build this little community and, you know, you want to
But now you're a part of it.
Yeah. And now I'm a part of it. It truly feels like a legacy.
You're not a builder developer that's in and gone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're a part of it. You own properties. And now that those rents.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if you're re-renting them today?
Cash flow nicely.
Right?
Yes.
So now you didn't stop there. You kind of went on.
Yep.
So what's the next project?
The next project is what I realized was that the real key to long-term success in real estate is to just keep doing stuff at your pace, at a good pace. Just keep doing it and stay away from these passion projects and other sexy projects. Do the basic stuff well and find a niche area for yourself and just keep doing that. So since my first development was in Bourbonnais, it was a townhome development, which did very, very, very well. After Veranda got, the first part of Veranda got done, I felt like I really wanted to go back to that. And so I recently bought my third development, which is another townhome development in
Bourbonnais.
Are you
going to keep that or are you going to sell it?
I'll keep it.
You'll keep this one. So you're going back to the basics.
Back to the basics.
And we were kind of talking about it before we started, that if you look at anybody who's super, super, super successful, you know, generally they are the best at repetitious boredom.
Yeah.
They figure one thing out and then they do it, and they do it better than anybody that is around, and they do it for a long, long, long period of time.
And it might become very tedious, might seem very boring, might not be exciting. And so many things look like much more fun to do. But the key to success is to just keep doing what you're good at for a long time.
And that's, if one thing, a realization I've come to realize personally, is somebody said a couple things, like somebody said, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And every time you say yes to something, you're saying no to something else.
So true.
Right? That that making money and doing passion projects are two completely different things. Right? I mean, I know like on TV, a lot of times you hear people, oh, if you just follow your passion, you know, it's all going to work out. Right? And that sounds great.
Yeah. Right?
It all sounds great. But I mean, I truly, truly believe that, I mean, there's a lot of people that are martyrs to their passion, because making money and just following it. Now, if you're lucky enough where your passion happens to make you a lot of money, that's different.
Yeah.
Right? But the two are not connected a lot of times.
Not connected a lot of times. And now, growing wiser after all of these experiences, I've learned to settle for just what's interesting. It doesn't have to excite me a lot. It doesn't have to be a great passion. It doesn't have to be the big purpose of my life. But if it's interesting enough, I'm happy with that.
But is that also a part of it, is phase of life?
Yeah, I guess so. It's like growing up.
Yeah, like it's just like, it's like, okay, I've done that. I've experimented. Do I really want to take on that level of stress, headache, and all? Because did that create, I mean, going through that sort of a thing, right? Your husband all these years has been amazingly supportive.
Very supportive.
Right? But I mean, I hate to say this, but it's the truth that these things lead to divorces. These things are terrible issues, right?
Yep.
Because I mean, any tantrums around this time? From your end, I'm not talking about your husband. Okay, we're going to keep him out of it.
Yeah, he doesn't. He's not the tantrum types.
This frustration
takes a toll.
Do you take a toll? I mean,
it takes a toll. And you always pay the price somewhere. And all of your stress comes out on your family members.
Right.
So your near and dear ones. And so it was an incredibly stressful period. It really made me realize too that, is this what I want to subject myself and my family to? When there's like so many better, albeit less exciting, but, you know, less risky projects to do in real estate, which I do very well. They're really my strength. And then that's what I wanted to go back to. So yeah, you learn your lesson.
So anybody listening, right? I mean, this is, we covered kind of a lot of things here. Anybody listening now, looking back, right? Where would you say, like when we were, like Corona, nobody could control, like what happened during COVID, nobody could control that sort of thing, right? But looking back, what were the things you would look back and say, oh my God, these things are something people should do? There are other things maybe you might have done. You're like, at the time it seems smart, but I would stay away from them because they're risky. What would you say?
I would say to wait for the right timing. Chicago market is now at an all-time high. And as we've learned from the history of thousands of years, that real estate is always cyclical. So there will be a time when this high market comes down. So wait for that time to come. You really do make your money when you buy low. And besides that, to understand what your niche is and keep doing that for a long period of time.
Stick to it. So because, I mean, this is something we were kind of laughing about, right? Everybody today is, man, money's multifamily, right? Money's here, money's there. What's your opinion on that? Like chasing the dollar in everything that the general public is doing?
I found that the general public is often clueless and seems to be chasing the wrong thing. You know, multifamily, like when people say multifamily are such a great investments, I don't know if they actually follow closely enough to know that multifamilies have done really poorly in the last 3 to 5 years, and the future doesn't look too bright either, not for the near future. But real estate investing shouldn't be about a fad or a trend. It should be really about basics. For me, what I've learned is like identify a geographic area, a city where you feel there's good fundamentals, where there's good stable employment. That might not be the financial center or the tech center or, you know, any big fancy center of the country, but just a nice stable town where crime is low, where there's good blue collar jobs, where there is stable employment, where taxes are low. If you found that kind of setup like close by to your base, then just stick to there and do as much there as you can.
You know, this has been really, really fun. This is something I intended to do for a long time. Just never worked out. But this has been awesome. I think for people who really understand the intricacies of real estate, right, this will be absolutely awesome. And for you, genuinely, what you've accomplished, not only on the physician side of it, but to abandon that and then go on to achieve what you've achieved, right? Your dad up there is going to be proud of his daughter, because I mean, I truly, truly feel a lot of us, right? All we are and all we will ever be is because of our mothers and fathers.
Truly. One of my dad's favorites were like grand. So when my mom came to see the completed development at Veranda, she said, you know, beta, it's grand. That made it all great for me.
Great having you. Guys, there's loads and loads of more content coming like this. So make sure you like, share, and subscribe, and we'll talk to you soon.
I hope you enjoyed the episode today on the Cash Flow for Life podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe on your chosen platform that you are listening to us on. If this episode made you think of someone, go ahead, take a screenshot and share this episode with them, or post it on your social media to share with your friends. Achieving financial freedom is all about creating the necessary cash flow in your life. Our team has designed an entire ecosystem for you to be able to not only become a successful real estate investor, but for you to build higher cash flows month after month. Join our community at www.nationalreinvest.com to see which event is coming up that you can be a part of and how you can be a part of our community. Once again, it's www.nationalreinvest.com. We will see you on the next episode.